And while the bosses and the lobbyists at the Metro Chamber cry about tax cuts, we desperately need direct assistance and protections for tenants. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna?
Good afternoon. I'm Anna Karnitsky, Executive Director of Community Warehouse, the Portland area's only furniture bank. I generally support this supplemental budget's investments in eviction prevention, acquisition of existing housing, rent assistance and rehousing. These are critical, especially after federal, state, and county cuts. From our vantage point, furnishing homes for thousands of families each year, full spectrum housing investments are what make the system work. When someone gets a housing voucher but has no furniture, their housing isn't functional or stable. The data shows when people transitioning out of homelessness receive coordinated support, they're most likely to succeed. Also, prevention is exponentially more effective than crisis response. The biggest indicator if someone will experience homelessness is if they've experienced it before. Eviction prevention must remain a priority. While this budget fills some gaps, we know it doesn't resolve everything, and we cannot keep making reactive decisions in crisis mode. Community Warehouse joins the Welcome Home Coalition and Housing Oregon in calling for the city and county to collectively and immediately map FY27 resources and gaps across all funding streams. Please engage service providers in service planning, strategic planning. We are on the front lines and we see what works. As you map resources, include the full spectrum of housing stability services. How are essential supports like furniture funded? I urge you to support these investments that address housing inequity, not additions to the general fund, and to commit to comprehensive resource mapping with service providers at the not proverbial table. Thank you.
That was an excerpt of the discussion at the Housing and Permitting Committee on a plan to spend down unspent millions found in the city's Housing Bureau. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Camp Bluegrass Pride, an LGBTQ+ bluegrass music group featuring hands-on workshops, one-on-one instruction, collaborative jams, and nightly concerts from June 21st through June 26th in Astoria, Oregon. All identities and skill levels welcome. More info at bluegrasspride.net.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. Tonight we're going to be talking about recent events in the news regarding trans people and also just some other general transgender related topics. Let's introduce ourselves real quick. I'm Nicolette and I use they, them pronouns.
My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is G and I use they, them pronouns.
My name is Sheila and I use she and her pronouns.
Great. Thank you for being here, everyone. So the first piece of news that I personally wanted to talk about Kansas. So many transgender people across Kansas received letters from the Division of Vehicles demanding they surrender their driver's licenses and stating that their current credentials will be considered invalid. The letter states that under House Substitute for Senate Bill 244, Kansas issued driver's licenses and ID cards must reflect their sex at birth. The letter notes that the legislature did not include a grace period for updating credentials, and anyone operating a vehicle without a valid license may be subject to additional penalties. Those whose gender marker does not align with their sex assigned at birth are directed to surrender their current credential to the Division of Vehicles for reissuance. Now, under Kansas law, driving without a valid license is a Class B misdemeanor, punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. And this conviction also triggers an automatic 90-day license suspension. If a person drives under that suspension, they face a charge of driving on a suspended license, which carries a mandatory minimum of 5 days in jail. And in Kansas, county jails house inmates according to their sex assigned at birth. SB 244 also bans trans people from using bathrooms associated with their gender identity in public buildings and creates a bathroom bounty hunter system, allowing citizens to sue trans people they encounter in restrooms for at least $1,000 in damages. So what do we all think about this?
Has that actually passed? Is it actually both Senate
House signed ready? It has actually passed. It was rushed through the House in January through a gut and go procedure, which means basically
and the Senate.
And the Senate, yes. They attempted to veto it, and that was overridden or overrode. Yes.
Yes, that's actually lost.
Well, can I speak to that right away?
Please.
What that it will inevitably do, it will cause a cascade of similar legislation in other states all around the country, and then it will have to be reviewed because there will have to be litigation on this, because once again the science is in favor of transgender identity and it gets very complicated when you deal with judicial review, the rational basis test versus strict scrutiny. But remember that there is a federal law in place that says that Title 60, that passed in 1964, that discrimination on the basis of sex is forbidden at the constitutional level. That includes the states. So this certainly does look like, based on sex, no overriding state interest. They have a very difficult time proving, even under the rational basis test, that this, especially when it goes against the requirements of the medical doctors that are treating transgender dysphoria, which is the fundamental thing that we go through. So it's targeting a discrete and insular minority, although they've never recognized transgender people as a discrete and insular minority. And that's magic language for saying that we distribute rights and protections by classes and not by individuals. We don't have this blanket thing that everyone assumes, that everyone has to be treated equally. We do it according to different categories that are held to be suspect. And this is clearly a vindictive sort of thing. It's not based on science. The mere fact that there was very little legislative debate, the fact that it was rushed through, the fact that they did not hear from experts, the fact that there was therefore very little legislative history to rely upon, means that it's just the naked words that they just say. We're just saying you can't do it. They're not saying what great public thing is going to be advanced or what harm is being prevented. So I think there's some hope there, but beware, there will be copycat statutes like this popping up like popcorn, and it shows that it's not just the federal government that's anti-trans right now. There is a groundswell of attacks against us that we are, along with black and brown skinned people and other insular minorities in this country, are under attack right now. There's just no denying it.
Thanks. Do you have anything you'd like to say about this?
Well, I agree 100%. And something I was thinking of as you were talking was the effects, the impacts this will have on people in an everyday kind of way. And while they wait, perhaps if there was a repeal or a lawsuit that gets filed, that there are human beings that get caught in the crosshairs. The scary thing is that people are already struggling. I know Kansas is a state that has continued to pass legislation, making it challenging for anyone to be out and trans. And so to continue that assault on people's rights is terrifying. And I'm just thinking about people's mental health. I'm thinking about parents who have children, what that means for people who continue to be marginalized, especially in jobs. What does this mean, you know, not being able to drive? This is going to greatly impact, the day-to-day lives of people, and hopefully, you know, they won't retreat, but I'm sure that's what the impact, the reverberating impact is going to be for everyday people in Kansas, and that's disturbing.
So, thank you. I'd like to say a couple of things about this this story, Nicolette. The first one is that it's probably unconstitutional. Legal advocates, especially the ACLU, have argued that forcing transgender people to carry IDs that contradict their gender identity can violate the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution and state constitutional protections against discrimination and invasion of privacy or autonomy. The law singles out transgender people and harms them without adequate justification. There's also been a lawsuit filed on behalf of transgender Kansans by the ACLU, and it states that refusing to let them have IDs that match their authentic identity interferes with their privacy, autonomy, and ability to safely navigate daily life, potentially conflicting with their constitutional rights. The Kansas government has ruled that requiring an ID to match a person's gender identity does not violate the Constitution, saying that a driver's license doesn't create a fundamental right to control what appears on it. So that's kind of what their side is saying. Transgendered Kansans have already filed lawsuits asserting their constitutional claims, and courts have responded differently at different times. Some rulings have upheld the ability to change gender markers. Others have sided with the state's interpretation of the law. The legal fight is ongoing, and either the U.S. Supreme Court or the Kansas Supreme Court will ultimately decide about this. Some advocates argue that the law violates constitutional protections, and there isn't any final binding ruling yet, meaning that this constitutional question regarding this law is unresolved as of right now. So it's an example of just because a state passes a law doesn't mean that it's legal. And we have, you know, an entire like generation of case law from the civil rights era to prove that. I mean, the kinds of laws that the South was passing, Southern states were passing against Black citizens during the civil rights era were just absolutely insane. You know, the most vile, racist, hateful kinds of laws that you can imagine. And they were all eventually overturned and invalidated and ruled unconstitutional, but it took a while. And I think that we're looking at what's going to be the beginning of a civil rights movement for transgender people and for queer people. I mean, I think that we're going to be part of a new social movement, a new civil rights movement in this country. And this is one of the places where that civil rights movement is going to begin to take place in a way that kind of ups the game a little bit because this is messing around with people's ability to safely navigate their lives. So that's what I have to say about it.
And I personally just also want to mention my concerns with the potential implications of motives and consequences of this bill. You know, a lot of people are speculating. First of all, are they just trying to keep trans people from driving so that, you know, not only do they not have as much ability to live their daily lives, but are they trying to keep them from escaping if they want to leave the state or just get away from whatever danger they're currently facing? Are they using this as a method of voter suppression? Because, you know, you would have to have a valid driver's license or ID in order to be able to vote. Are they intentionally trying to put more trans people in jail where they can potentially be assaulted, especially since these jails are, you know, housed according to your assigned sex at birth? Like, that's going to open up a lot of trans people to being assaulted. So that, on top of this whole bounty hunter system with the bathrooms, it just seems to me like they're trying to keep trans people from existing in public. They're trying to keep trans people from escaping harm, and they're trying to push trans people into further harm. That's just what I wanted to voice.
No, you're correct in that, because if you think about it, it's a big deal to change your driver's license. And then if the thing is ruled unconstitutional, switching back and forth, it definitely sends a "you are not welcome" thing. And it also is, at this point, it's reverse social engineering, because transgender is everywhere now. This is wishful thinking to think that you could put the, you know, to stick the jack-in-the-box back in the jack-in-the-box. I mean, it's all sprung right now. People dress in all kinds of ways. They have tattoos. I mean, trying to define what's permissible clothing, which type of clothing represents what orientation or anything, nobody can tell. It's just, so it's literally trying to recreate their little dream world of the 1950s. It's not going to happen. But the thing is that in the meantime, they can frighten us. They can make us feel unwelcome. And it's very similar to what they call cultural genocide, where you don't kill people, you just erase them. You just make it impossible for them to express themselves and or to go about and fulfilling generally public available public spaces, because no matter where you go, there's going to be problems. If you're depending on how well you pass, if you're going into the other restroom, you're going to either get massive eye contact or people that are going to say, "You don't belong here." And so the bottom line is saying, in public spaces, you don't belong. And it's very similar to making Jewish people wear the Star of David as an identifier. Of course, that had to be worn on the outside of your clothing just to let someone know it was like a badge of opprobrium. And it starts like this, and then it avalanches. And it's just at some point, people have to decide, what kind of world do we want to live in? If they think that is a more civil society, it certainly is not. It's an appalling society, but we're already there. We're in a fascist environment, and it's a lot bigger than Donald Trump. He wouldn't have been elected if there wasn't a groundswell of support for exactly these kinds of things.
Thanks. A couple of things if you want to help out. The ACLU of Kansas is involved in litigation fighting for transgender people, and a couple of other groups that are fighting for transgender people in Kansas are Equality Kansas, which is the statewide LGBTQ advocacy group, and there's also Lambda Legal, which is working on ID and documentation case. There's also a lot of mutual aid going on. So, I mean, there's people who are like helping right now to get support to Kansans. There's about 1,700 transgender people in Kansas who this is affecting, at least according to the most recent information that I've been able to find. And there is mutual aid that's going on right now to help people replace the cost of their IDs, or if they want to leave the state. There's like a transgender underground kind of process going on right now to get people out of unsafe states like Kansas now, Texas, Florida. And it's pretty easy to find those mutual aid groups. So there's a lot going on. Also, you can write to, even if you don't live in Kansas, you can write to Kansas legislators and tell them what you think about this. I mean, it doesn't hurt to send a letter or a message to somebody who has passed this hateful legislation just to tell them, you know, how this is really impacting people who are just trying to live their lives. So why don't we move on to our next story, Nicolette?
Sure. I have a bit more positive news. In more positive news, the American Psychological Association has reaffirmed support for gender-affirming care for transgender youth. A recent New York Times article written by anti-trans activist Jesse Singel claimed that there were, quote, cracks in the wall around gender-affirming care. Singel used a statement from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons that bypassed the organization's review process and was advanced under pressure from leadership associated with the Trump administration, and suggested that the APA has retreated from its 2024 position supporting gender-affirming care for minors. But recently, in response, a representative from the APA has made a statement that the APA's position has not changed and that the APA continues to support unobstructed access to evidence-based care for gender and diverse individuals of all ages.
Yeah, that's great news. I mean, the official statement of the APA is that the APA supports access to psychological care an evidence-based treatment for transgender, gender-diverse, non-binary children, adolescents, and adults, with decisions made jointly by families, clinicians, and the young person. The APA condemns bans on gender-affirming care, stating that laws restricting access ignore science, ignore scientific research, showing that this care can improve the health outcomes and protect well-being. And the APA emphasizes that obstructing access to care violates principles of evidence-based healthcare, human rights, and social justice. So, yeah, that's a great story, Nicolette.
Yeah. Something a bit more positive after that. All right. So, what shall we move on to next?
Yeah, let's move on to Sheila or G, whoever
would
like to go next.
Do you have thoughts? Do either of you have thoughts?
A very brief comment on it. The struggle for legitimacy, which is what essentially we're talking about here, is that transgender existence as transgender, does that belong to a category that is recognized as being part of the human equation, that that's not some personal aberration, it's not a temporary thing, it's not a delusion, it's not something that's only happening in certain countries and not in others. There are words for transgender people in different cultures around the world, so it's there. Anthropologically, it's there. Culturally, it's dealt with in different ways by different cultures. But the question is modern Western industrial society going to recognize gender variance, or is it not? And psychologists are saying, since it exists, and since non-cooperation or coercive methods to contain these feelings causes extreme stress in transgender individuals, best care practices in a, quote, caring society would be to lessen that pain. That is not the way that cultures define themselves. That's the way the most empathetic and professional part of our culture does. And we need to recognize that the social sciences are not like physics and chemistry. There's always going to be a somewhat ideological component there. But just because there's an ideological component doesn't mean it's phony. It just means that this particular aspect of our society says we need to make room for everybody. We're living in a world right now where the cultural imperatives are going in an opposite direction. They're saying we do not need to make room for everybody, because making room for everybody makes the other people, the dominant classes or the dominant culture or the dominant race in that particular culture, feel uneasy. And so we're going to say your enemy aliens to people that are with black or brown skin. We're going to define people as we don't have room for you. And our community traditionally knew how to deal with that. They said, fine, we will create our own little subculture, and we go to our places, we keep our money in the gay community or the transgender community, and we just adapt. But the problem is we've gone through a period of thawing, like a glacier thawing or a little warm spell, and everybody's taken off their shirts and everyone says, oh my God, it's January and the sun is shining. And all of a sudden we're back to freezing winter again. And that's something that when my turn to just bring up my topic, that's what I want to talk about. What do we do when we're up against a cultural change that makes us invisible again? Can we adapt to that?
Great, thanks. Well, why don't we go to G and we'll see what G would like to share, and then we'll go to Sheila to kind of close out the show. So, G?
Yeah. First off, I just want to say thank you for inviting me on, Emma, and that it's really a privilege. I'm really excited to be, you know, someone who's bringing this kind of the news, visibility, critique, analysis across the airwaves to people who, if you have an app, you can stream it. And that's really wonderful in terms of access these days, especially for people who, let's say, are living in states like Texas or Kansas or Florida. So just a big thanks, feeling a lot of gratitude. And I know for folks here, I am new. My name is G. I use they, them pronouns. I am relatively new to Portland. I have been out as transgender for several years now. And all of these topics of conversation so far have been really... get my brain going. And something I think that y'all have said or have told me that you've talked about is the idea of there being a mounting legislation and mounting opinion against transgender folks and anyone who has shows any sort of gender variance. So I've been thinking a lot about genocide, and I know y'all have discussed this. And so this is just something that I don't think I've talked about in community yet. And so I think it ties in really well with Sheila's topic on how we remain okay, or how do we deal with all of this intense, the onslaught, against our who we are, in a way that helps keep us afloat. And so I think one of those things is validating within your own community, getting validation that this is real, that this is going on, and our experiences really matter. And we're not making things up, especially when we're looking at the news and we are looking at reporting coming out of, you know, credentialed journalists writing about this stuff, and having something like the APA affirm the need for gender-affirming care, right? So I think, yeah, it's just something I've been thinking more about. I know it can be really challenging when I look to family members or people in my community who aren't as maybe as aware or acutely understanding of my experience or other transgender people's experiences. So it can get a little disheartening for me to feel like I am a voice in the void. And so it's really wonderful to have moved to Portland. That seems to be a very trans affirming city, although we are living in America. And so I can get quite bogged down and disheartened. And again, just want to bring up that hearing from people within our community that what we're experiencing is real, our anxieties are valid, that we're not overblowing these sorts of news articles, news stories, that the legislation in one state definitely impacts us across the United States. As we've mentioned, this is going to, something in Kansas can spark other legislation in other states. And so being able to have a conversation like this in community really is a privilege for me. And it's something that I think I've been lacking personally, and really just chomping at the bit to get involved with, to not feel so alone and feel more empowered. You know, I do like to go to my support groups, but sometimes I feel like the support groups are not enough. And there's something really healing about being in a space of with people who are really well-researched, very articulate and eloquent, and who've maybe been around a little bit longer and know what they're talking about and see me for who I am and say, you are valid, you're not alone, and we're here with you. And so that's just something I wanted to talk a little bit about, I guess, people's experiences with this. And it also ties in really well, again, with what Sheila is bringing up. And so if we want to move into that, if you want to comment on this. Sure. But
how about if we do both? Yeah, first sure. of all, I just want to say welcome to the collective, G. It's really nice to have you. And that was actually really positive. It wasn't so much about genocide. It was actually a pretty positive comment you just had.
Well, beautiful. I get worried sometimes that I'm too depressing. So that's great feedback.
It was, yeah.
I actually quite lifted the mood.
Yeah, it really did. So yeah. Thank you. And G was at the KBOO. We had the KBOO community meeting in February, and I had a chance to meet G at the KBOO community meeting. We had a great turnout at the KBOO community meeting. About maybe 75 people showed up, and everybody had a chance to talk about what they want out of their community radio station, and all the board was there, and there was some staff, and lots of longtime KBOO folks. And we all just kind of listened to each other talk about what do we want with our community radio station. So it was really great to make that connection with G. And nice to have you on the Collective G. And we look forward to doing more shows with you. So why don't we move on to Sheila? Because Sheila has some really great stuff that I know that Sheila wants to talk about the anxiety that we're all experiencing right now. So Sheila, would you like to go ahead with your section?
Yes, I would. Right now, the one magic phrase that our recognition, our quote official recognition is the magic words gender dysphoria, which sounds very impressive because the minute you translate something into Latin or Greek, it suddenly sounds like it's respectable. What it really means is that trans people aren't happy. And they're not happy in the way that they are constrained to send out social cues, particularly in public, that allow people to put people into one camp or another. You're either male or female. And once that initial assignment is made, a whole set of societal implications, societal definitions get triggered. We expect different things from different sexes in emotional expression, in clothing expression, and we even have an idea of what their life is, how it's going to unfold. Are they going to be the wage earner in the family? Are they going to, or is this a person that can become pregnant, whether identifying as male or female? What does that mean? A vehicle of life to a new generation? So much gets triggered. And so in the old days, the assumption was that there's only two camps. And once you had enough social triggers to indicate that you belong to one or the other of those camps, ka-ching, ka-ching, here comes the gate of the castle comes down, and people are going to be on one side or the other of that. There's no identifying as they, them. It's either he or she or nothing. And the nothing is what genocide is about. The nothing is when we're going to define you as, if we can't put you in a camp, we're going to just say, then you're out of here. We're not going to deal with you. And that's what invisibility means. That's what genocide means. That's what making people live in a constant state of exposure means, that somebody is going to get in drag language, know the tea about you, you know. And usually displaced groups of people have what's called in the drag community, which drew a lot from the Black community experience, is called throwing shade on somebody, which is basically, or other magic words were like, they clocked me or they read me. And to be clocked or read was being to be identified as a trans person by someone that's not trans. They said, you're not really a girl, or you're not really a man. And the really on that word really is everything. So then this was RG, is a real girl versus a trans girl or a T girl. So even our own language began to absorb some of that assignment of who we were. But the bottom line is there room in a diverse society to make room for people that in various gender expressions makes them non-assignable without reducing them to the null set of saying you're a zero, you don't belong anywhere? And that's the thing that really causes our anxiety. It's not an imagination, because in a highly gender conscious society, to be misassigned or to meet questioning or suspicious stares like you don't belong here is profoundly anxiety provoking. And the way that a lot of trans people dealt with it was they said, well, I can't be my real self out there in public. I just can't. I can't handle the stress of it. And others said, I can do it, but I have to be within my own little ghetto community where I can go to my clubs, or I can go to my bars, or I can go to places and heave a sigh of relief and know that at least they're not going to break down the door like they did at the stone wall to try to break. You know, actually, it was the trans community that probably led that charge, to try to, because the police took it. Was like a reversal of roles. It was, that's what made it so epic, is that the police that came to harass the trans people finally had to seek shelter in, and everybody else was outside yelling at them, and they just panicked because they got to experience what it was like to have their own crush, their own identity as law enforcement people, and being told your enforcement is not valid because you're harassing our community. You aren't welcome in this neighborhood. Get out. And I think that if we can live through this era and know that we've already made it through the AIDS era, and we made it through so many things where our community has had to stand together and not go down, we need to never forget those skills. Out of our history comes our chance to be strong in the future. And unfortunately, if you're a really young person, especially a minor, imagine how difficult that is to have, on the one hand, so many options. We can do hormone blockers. We can prevent a premature puberty. You don't have to undo secondary sexual characteristics in the latter part of your life that you acquired before you had any agency over your own body. And now, with all that hope that was dangled in front of them, all of a sudden state after state saying, you can't do anything with trans people. And if your parents help you in your transition, we're going to treat them as child abusers, by being empathetic. And then Trump's ridiculous State of the Union speech brought up the thing of saying, well, the schools are trying to keep the transgender identity hidden from the parents, and they're the ones that are raising the child. And then at different times, he implies that you could go to school one day one sex and come back the other, which of course physiologically is not going to happen. But even the assignment is threatening for them because they don't like you to be called by your pronouns or by your chosen name. So I guess what I'm basically saying here is we need to ask ourselves, what is our experience and how does that experience come across? Trump put it this way: anybody that supports trans people is a crazy person themselves. And they are, we're going to get rid of all that. And that's when we get back to that thing of being defined as nothing. And that's what genocide is.
Well, great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Sheila, for sharing that. And G and Nicolette, would it be okay if I shared a section now with, we have about 13 minutes left in the show, and I did some news prep for the show tonight, and I'd love to get some of the news stories. How do people feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to mention a few news items that have come up in the last month that I think are still going to be relevant when the show airs. The first one, which I think is really significant, is that there has been a federal prison ban on gender-affirming care. this is very comprehensive, and it's really disturbing. And for me personally, as somebody who volunteers in the prison, and I also do a prison radio show here on KABU, and I'm also a fervent abolitionist, as somebody who's an abolitionist and has done work on, volunteering with folks who are incarcerated, this really concerns me. We've done a few shows about what it's like to be transgender in prison. I've worked in prisons. I mean, I've volunteered in prisons with people when they're able to get gender appropriate placement within Oregon state prisons. But this is a federal prison story. There's about 1,000 people incarcerated in the United States right now who are transgender, who are in federal prisons. And the policy changes from the Federal Bureau of Prisons have been issued restricting gender-affirming care. What this means is that incarcerated people who are in prison right now are not going to be able to have access to hormones. They're not going to be able to have access to gender-affirming surgeries. They're not going to be able to have access to clothing that reflects their gender identity. If they're already getting care for gender-affirming, for gender dysphoria, that care is going to be discontinued. And in addition to that, they're also going to be forced to detransition. So, for instance, transgender women who've been incorrectly placed in a male's prison are going to be forced to wear male clothing. They're going to have their hormones taken away from them. And regardless of their status, like their surgical status, they're going to have to be housed with men, which means that they're going to be at risk of rape and of sexual abuse, harassment, violence, and intimidation. So this is very concerning that the federal government is basically willing to throw away the lives of almost 1,000 people who are in prison. The point of prison is that it's supposed to be a place for reflection and for at its best, it should be a place where people are allowed to grow and to change and to, you know, hopefully learn from their past mistakes. I mean, I've interviewed lots and lots of people who've done time in federal prison. Usually you go to federal prison for something like robbing a bank. And I've talked to people who've been in prison, and even though I'm an abolitionist, prison for some people has given them a chance to get clean if they're suffering from a drug addiction or some other kind of chemical substance addiction. Sometimes if they're in a really rough place, like if they're in a really nasty, really awful relationship with somebody who's taking advantage of them, sometimes prison gives them a break from that. And the really big thing that I've noticed from prison, and again, this is not to speak positively of it, is that people who need mental health care will oftentimes at least get some of the basics that they need, and they'll get like their medications arranged in a way that like helps them to kind of get a grip on what's going on in their lives. But this is not any of those things. This is the exact opposite of that. This is the absence of care. It's the erasure of people who are human beings and deserve to be treated with dignity and with respect. And it's going to be very, very harmful, especially to all of the trans women who are going to be put in men's prisons, forced to wear male clothing. But it's like all the men there are still going to know that they're transgender, and they're all going to be at risk of rape and even death. So it's very frightening. This is a very, very frightening time for transgender people who have been arrested and incarcerated. And this is like one of the worst policy decisions that I've heard in the last 10 or 15 years regarding the treatment of transgender people. So that's one story I wanted to share. Does anybody have anything they'd like to comment on that story?
Yeah, I know that, like, just I'm horrified just because of somebody I know. So I have a friend who is one of those 1,000 people you're talking about. She is a trans woman that is being kept in a men's prison, which I think is just awful to begin with. And recently, you know, she asked for gender affirming care while in the prison. They started off with, right now they're just letting her wear women's clothes and women's undergarments. And she's been telling me about how even just that little bit helps her feel a lot better. You know, she is alleviating some of her gender dysphoria and having some gender euphoria just by being allowed to wear women's clothes. And, you know, she was hoping to be able to go through HRT and all that while she's in prison. And now it sounds like they're going to take all of that away from her. Even that one little thing that gives her that little bit of joy, that little bit of relief from that discomfort that she feels. Like, I feel so sorry for her if that's going to affect her that way. And that makes me really want to reach out to my friend now and see if she's okay. So, yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. That is really, really awful to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to add that this change in policy is a direct violation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which is an act of Congress. And it's actually one of the most important things that's being taught to folks who are volunteering in the prisons. It's like constantly reinforced among corrections staff that this is something that we have to watch out for and we have to be conscious of, is that just because you're incarcerated doesn't mean that you lose your basic sense of safety and that you can be raped. And this policy is basically saying is that you can rape trans women. It's like the rape trans women policy decision of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, because that's exactly what's going to happen to trans women. They're going to be put in men's prison. They're going to get raped. They're going to get beaten. They're going to get intimidated, and they're going to have really difficult lives. Either that or else they're going to be put in solitary confinement, which is psychological torture. And this is how the federal, prisons deal with all kinds of people. I mean, they deal with people who have mental health issues, who have drug addictions, who come from all kinds of backgrounds. They have lots of programs to like help support all sorts of people who are incarcerated. And to think that they would just so blatantly drop standards of care for over 1,000 people and put them at risk, especially at risk of PREA, which is kind of the gold standard of how you're supposed to protect people who are incarcerated, it just speaks volumes about this administration and just how utterly evil it is. So I'd like to move on, if that's okay, unless somebody else has anything else they'd like to say about that.
I have a comment on how we use prisons in our society.
I realize that there are violent people that have to be curtailed in some way, and it usually has to be fairly intrusive. But I think there's a lot of people in prison that are mentally ill and do not belong in prison as it's presently constituted. But I believe that the threat of prison, something hanging over us, not just to help us not steal and not to commit violent offenses, but just the knowledge that there's a something out there that's scary, is a form of social control. And I would like to believe that there's such a thing as a benevolent society, that the laws and everything that we have around us makes us a better and more humane people. But I think it'd be extremely naive to assume that our society is anything less than predatory at the present time. And I think we the way we treat debtors, the way we treat student debt, the way we don't let them declare bankruptcy, there's so many different areas of our life, it's very clear that we're in the jungle and there are predators out there. So I think the one thing I always try to end with is to say we have to be very, very careful to take good care of ourselves mentally, socially, in our relationships, and in our self-custody, that we stay well nourished, that we make sure that we don't isolate, that we don't allow these things that are being thrown upon us to sink into us so that we become our own persecutors. We don't want to do that. We have to hang together and stand together and be proud of ourselves. That's what the annual Freedom Day parade is all about.
Thanks. There's one other story I want to share that's not really a good news story. This hasn't really been a good news week for transgender news, even though this is March is Trans Visibility Month. And I do want to remember that this is a month when we celebrate transgender identities. It's also Women's History Month. So this is a month when we celebrate transgender visibility. Trans Day of Visibility comes up this month. And it's a good month for celebrating transgender identities. I hate talking about all the negative news that's happening right now, but I think it is important as journalists that we confront these stories head on. So I'm going to just share one more story that's kind of disappointing, and then we will kind of wrap up the show for tonight. It's a story of a major healthcare provider in the South, in the American South, Vanderbilt University, that is a place where people in southern states were going to get gender-affirming healthcare. And they announced in February that they were going to be ending all gender-affirming healthcare, not just for kids, not just for teenagers, which, you know, state legislators have been threatening to send people to prison for providing gender-affirming healthcare for minors. But this is, they're actually ending all gender-affirming surgery for anyone, including all adults. And so this follows on the heels of Boston. I can't remember if it was Boston University. It was a hospital in Boston which made a similar decision. And they're going to be. It says that they. The story is that they Vanderbilt University retreated from providing gender affirming healthcare and gender affirming surgeries due to political pressure. And they were also told that this was a corporate risk management issue, and that this was basically, this raises some serious questions. It asks if hospitals are becoming politicized, if hospitals and healthcare providers are becoming politicized and weaponized against transgender people. And is there a legal liability in this? Like, is there a responsibility? Do institutions that provide medical care have a medical liability? Do they have a legal liability to provide, you know, the most appropriate and affirming healthcare to people who come there? So like, if you went to a hospital and you had a broken leg and the hospital said, oh, we're no longer going to treat broken legs, you know, or we're no longer going to provide cancer care because we don't believe in that, you know, is that similar to this? I mean, you know, it's like we were saying earlier in the show, This is evidence-based care. And the standards of care for transgender healthcare have been well established within the medical profession. Everything that's happening right now, all of the lies you're hearing about, all of the propaganda you're hearing about from the Trump administration and from Republicans, it's all propaganda. None of it's based in science. There isn't any evidence for anything that they're claiming. And the kind of political pressure that they're putting on educators, that they're putting on hospitals, that they're putting on healthcare providers, it's all just propaganda to feed their hate mill. Because everything that's been done in the last 10 years has all been evidence-based, and it's been based on the idea of providing the most appropriate medical care possible to people who are seeking medical care. And so this story of Vanderbilt doing this is just really sad, because it's going to affect a lot of people who had been going to Vanderbilt in order to get their care. So I just kind of wanted to end with that story, but I would love it if we kind of did a wrap up. If Nicolette, if you could kind of lead us in a wrap up, and we'll all kind of go around and just reflect on the show tonight and just, you know, say goodnight. So do you want to close this out, Nicolette?
Sure. I mean, do we all want to go around and say our final thoughts?
Well, here's what I've noticed about societies that are becoming increasingly repressive. They start with the low-hanging fruit. They go after the people that are the least likely to be noticed. They go after people that are have mental issues, that are impoverished, that are elderly. They go after people that can't fight back. But then that same repression, as they become more successful at doing that, it only moves further and further along until finally they step on so many toes that everybody begins to recognize that we're finally just all human beings here. And when it gets like that, then you get the end stage fascism. And so ultimately, the fact that they're coming for us first is kind of an honor in a way, because it says that whatever it is that we're trying to do in our lives and is not easy for us. I don't think anybody has gone around trying to say, I'm not sure if I'm trans. Let's see if I can develop it. Let's see if I can nurture and water the seed and make it sprout. I don't think that's our experience. And so the fact that they're coming for us first indicates that we may be onto something here, and that we can be an example to others. Don't start for us, because you're going to finally end with a very unsavory society if you eliminate the trans people.
Great, thank you. G, would you like to?
Sure. This was a doozy emotionally for me, personally. But it was really important for me to hear all of the sweeping legislation and the impacts this will have across the nation, state by state, at an individual level. I just thinking of what Sheila has said and has said previously as well, I was thinking about a tattoo that I saw someone had at Gay Skate Night. It was a transgender flag across her forearms, and it said, "Another world is possible." And so I think I like to think of that often, especially when I'm overwhelmed. And I know, Emma, you mentioned March is Trans Visibility Month. And so I know a lot of people like to think about that as a placeholder to think about our history, think about the people who have stood up and continued to fight to remain visible in spite of movements wanting to have them shut up and sit down. And so we have a historical legacy as transgender people of continuing to say, no, we will refuse to be silenced. We have and will continue to exist. And so I'm heartened by some of the news where there are people who are still allies who are working to lend their voice to the cause, the transgender cause, to sum that up. But
another world is possible, and we are proof that it is, and we're beautiful as we are. And we give a lot of other people the courage to speak up and explore and find creativity. And I am so thankful for that, in spite of everything that is going on right now telling me that maybe I shouldn't exist. I also see in other people, in other trans people, the exact opposite, which is that what I see in myself, I see in others. There's beauty, brilliance, creativity that it will always continue to shine. And I'm just continuing to hope that, you know, this show will be a beacon for people. And again, I'm just really grateful. So thanks for having me.
Well, great. G, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to KBOO. And we're really great to have you on Transpositive. Nicola, do you want to close this out?
Yeah. Thank you for joining us, everyone. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening and supporting us. Let's keep on the good fight. So thanks again for listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Radio. Have a good night, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Great.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you catch the Bluegrass Marathon? If you enjoyed the programming, you can show your support for KBOO and music from the True Vine by purchasing a commemorative